This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
Japanese nuclear plant, Libyan forces launch another airstrike on Ajdabiya. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Japanese officials say radiation levels have reached dangerous levels around the earthquake-damaged nuclear plant after a fire broke out in a storage pond holding used nuclear fuel rods. In a nationally televised statement today, Prime Minister Naoto Kan said the radiation level is very high and that there is a high risk of more radiation escaping. Anyone living within 30 kilometers of the Fukushima nuclear plant have been urged to remain indoors. Increased radiation has been detected as far away as Tokyo. For more on this story, visit our website, voanews.com. Japan's stock market plunged for a second day. Investors are worried about the economic toll of Friday's earthquake and tsunami. That sent Tokyo's Nikkei index down more than 10% at today's close. Forces loyal to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi have launched another airstrike on the rebel-held eastern town of Ajdabiya, moving closer to the rebels' main stronghold of Benghazi. Witnesses said today's aerial bombings hit the town's western edge. The French news agency says at least one fighter was killed in the assault. France's foreign minister says his country has not yet convinced its group of eight partners to support its push to impose a no-fly zone over Libya in an effort to ground Libyan warplanes. Alain Juppé made the statement today on Europe One Radio. Top diplomats from the world's leading industrialized nations have been gathering in Paris since Monday, discussing a response to the situation in Libya. Iran has called the military intervention in Bahrain by other countries unacceptable. The criticism from the Western Shiite country comes a day after a Saudi-led military force entered the small Gulf kingdom to support its minority Sunni government. North Korea says it is willing to discuss its uranium enrichment program without preconditions if six-nation talks on its nuclear programs are resumed. The official KCNA news agency announced the offer today in a report on a visit to Pyongyang by Russia's top official for the six-party talks. Conflicts within the cabinet of President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono have hindered efforts to improve the economy, crack down on corruption, and promote tolerance within society. Some say the president's welcoming opponents into his cabinet has actually weakened his ability to govern. Brian Patton has a report.
Although President Yudhoyono won a landslide re-election victory in 2009, his Democratic Party controls only 25% of the seats in parliament. To gain a working majority there, the president invited rival parties to join a grand coalition and awarded cabinet positions to opposing party officials. But instead of creating a unified government, political analysts say some cabinet members and coalition partners are working to undermine the president. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
South Korea says its northern neighbor has agreed to accept the repatriation of 27 people whose fishing boat drifted across the border, ending a two-week standoff. The North had refused since early this month to accept the return of any members of the group unless it received all 31 men and women who were aboard the boat. The South says it will not return two men and two women who had asked to defect. Tribal forces in central Yemen have kept an oil pipeline ablaze and have damaged roads leading to it. Officials say the sabotage occurred in Marib province, where oil pipelines are repeatedly damaged. It's unclear if the damage was connected to anti-government protests. The commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, appears before lawmakers on Capitol Hill today to discuss the military effort in Afghanistan. Petraeus is testifying at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. Afghan officials say separate bomb blasts in the country's east have killed a provincial lawmaker and a school principal. Officials say the provincial council member was killed in an explosion today in Laghman province. The principal was killed in Nangarhar province by a bomb blast inside his school. Asia-Pacific stock markets closed sharply lower today. European markets are lower in midday trading. I'm Dave DeForest. We're at voanews.com.
Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, a fire breaks out at Japan's damaged nuclear power plant. We assess the impact of Japan's crisis on the country's economy, and we continue our look at the United States from a South Korean perspective. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. The crisis at Japan's damaged nuclear power complex in the northeastern part of the country is worsening. Japanese officials say radiation levels have reached dangerous levels around the nuclear plant after a fire broke out in a storage pond holding used nuclear fuel rods. Today's fire was the latest setback for operators of the Fukushima nuclear plant, which suffered a failing of its cooling systems following last week's earthquake and tsunami. All non-essential staff were evacuated from the plant before the fire was extinguished shortly before noon local time. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is in Koryama, 75 kilometers to the west of the nuclear plant in the prefecture.
Tuesday morning, Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan delivered a nationally broadcast message to citizens after a third reactor building explosion was confirmed here in Fukushima. Urging the public to heed his words calmly, Mr. Kan acknowledged one of the damaged reactors is facing a much higher risk of releasing radiation into the atmosphere. The Prime Minister asked those living between 20 and 30 kilometers from the plant to stay indoors. Those living closer, about 200,000 people in all, had previously evacuated. After Mr. Kan finished his statement, Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Edano met with reporters. The top government spokesman said radiation detected at another damaged reactor, the number 3 unit, was at a level that could harm people. The highest brief spike of radiation levels at the crippled Fukushima plant was equivalent to 8 times the dose an average person would absorb in a year. The Tokyo Electric Power Company announced that the cooling system had failed at the number 2 reactor of the Fukushima complex. Industry sources say cooling equipment had been damaged by last Friday's magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami. The utility says all workers from the Fukushima plant, except those involved in the emergency pumping of water to cool the reactors, have been ordered out of the facility. The Kyoto News Agency quotes an official at the company saying, "It is possible that some parts of the rods holding nuclear material have melted." If confirmed, that would be a new and more alarming worry for Japan. Tokyo Electric says there are also big problems at the number 4 reactor, which had previously had its fuel rods removed but still contains spent fuel. A fire has been extinguished there from an apparent explosion of a fuel container which damaged the reactor's ceiling. Radioactive steam has been released from that reactor. Monday, Japan asked for assistance from the International Atomic Energy Agency. Japanese domestic news reports say small levels of radioactive iodine and cesium have been detected in the Tokyo metropolitan area, about 250 kilometers to the southwest from here in Fukushima Prefecture. Although authorities say there is no cause for alarm, there is concern these reports could trigger panic, putting additional stress on Japan's communications and transportation infrastructure, which have already deteriorated because of the huge quake and tsunami. Steve Herman, VOA News, Koryama, Japan.
For more on the Japanese nuclear crisis, I spoke with Daniel Aldrich, assistant professor at Purdue University in Indiana and the author of two books, Sight Flights on Nuclear Power in Japan and Building Resilience on Disaster Recovery. I asked him, what does a meltdown mean?
So in this case, this is not the kind of meltdown readers or listeners might imagine from Chernobyl, where the reactor literally was so hot, it melted through not only the core floor of the business itself and down into the ground. This is a smaller scale meltdown, where the fuel rods themselves have not been cooled down by water or normally by other cooling fluids. So in this case, it means the fuel gets so hot that the rods themselves melt, and it's uncontrolled. It's possible that this could build into a larger meltdown. But right now, to our knowledge, this is only called a partial meltdown, not a complete or catastrophic meltdown. So it's really not perhaps as bad as it looks from the outside.
And so this is the importance of getting water into this plant.
Exactly. In fact, when the engineers in Japan began to use seawater to try and cool off the fueling rods, that was a sign, in a sense, of how desperate things had become for two different reasons. There are actually three different levels of backups at these reactors in Japan. That is, there are three different mechanisms that should come online when standard systems fail. And the fact that all three of them did not work, and having to use cooling water, shows how severe the tsunami was, which overwhelmed both the batteries and the diesel generators there, and also perhaps the unpreparedness that we have as a whole across the world for an 8.9 or 9.0 magnitude earthquake. That is, these plants were really not designed to withstand a powerful blast like that that happened. The second thing that we're seeing now also, by using cooling water from the ocean, the engineers are basically admitting these plants will never work normally again. By allowing seawater into these reactors, they're basically destroying the very delicate machinery and the fuel rods themselves and the overall cladding around them, so that these reactors, to my knowledge at least, won't come back online. You might imagine, for example, after this is all over in a few weeks when things have calmed down, they'll pump it out and start again. They actually can't do that. Once you introduce salt water into these reactors, that in a sense is the end game for them, and they'll have to be decommissioned. And so we now know of the six reactors nearby, at least two, possibly three or four of them, are being shut down by the very process used to save them. That will be a very costly financially, costly in terms of time, and costly in terms of energy production, because of course Japan relies heavily. Almost one-third of all electricity in Japan comes from reactors. Shutting these down forever, which is what's going to happen, will create a very large gap between demand and supply, and liquid natural gas and oil and other alternatives, which are of course more carbon dioxide producing, will be necessary next.
How far does nuclear fallout, how far does it travel?
Well, we know from Chernobyl that if it's a tremendously large full meltdown, as we had there in Russia, it's possible to travel literally thousands of miles in the atmosphere. From Three Mile Island, though, which I think is a better comparison to what's going on now, the maximum distance we think it traveled was just a few miles, at least measurably, in terms of the effect on population. In fact, Three Mile Island never had provable health effects on local residents there, even though it was a tremendous problem here in America, and perhaps shut down the American nuclear power system as a whole. We actually don't have a lot of proof that, for example, there are more cancers in the area or more leukemia in the area. It's very difficult, unfortunately, for science to pin down the exact causes of disease, whether it's a high-profile disease like cancer, for example, or more subtle ones, leukemia, for example, and thyroid problems. Those are harder to pin down. So I think in this case, the effects are probably contained mostly within a few mile radius of the plants.
Are these reactors considered well-designed and modern?
Modern, no. Well-designed at the time, yes. Interestingly enough, when these were built, and these are actually pretty old reactors, many reactors around the world are this age. These are actually 40 years old, these ones that are having problems now. When they were designed, they were state-of-the-art. And Japan made, actually GE built them. Japan required GE to take into account seismic possibilities, like an earthquake, for example, and again to build multiple backup systems in case there was a tremendous problem. So at the time, you know, 40-odd years ago, when these were being planned, designed, and constructed, yes, these were the best that we could do in terms of engineering. The reality is that the basic technology itself hasn't changed that much. The average technology is sort of what one of my professors once told me, it's like a big way to boil water. And these reactors are doing the same thing, or they try to do the same thing. Even the newest generation of advanced boiling water reactors, ABWRs, are more or less the same technology, perhaps with a thicker containment shield, perhaps with more safeguards. But at the core of the reactor, they haven't changed much in four decades.
Daniel Aldrich, assistant professor at Purdue University in Indiana, speaking about Japan's nuclear crisis following last week's earthquake and tsunami. Well, meanwhile, Japan's stock market plunged for a second day today in the wake of the earthquake and tsunami. Investors worried about the economic toll sent Tokyo's Nikkei index down more than 10% at the close, one of the steepest one-day drops on record. That followed a sell-off of more than 6% on Monday. Other Asian markets also recorded steep losses. Vishnu Varathan is an Asia analyst with Capital Economics Group in Singapore. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the sharp declines are caused by concerns about further aftershocks and ongoing problems with the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The problem, I think, really is that there's still a great deal of uncertainty about the damage in terms of, whether in dollar terms or in terms of human life loss, which is the more tragic part of it, of course. And besides that, you know, there's also a lot of uncertainty about a potential nuclear disaster.
Do you see a trend developing here? This is the worst two-day plunge in Japan since 1987.
What we can quite safely say is that the reaction of the market is not unexpected. The earthquake turned out to be a lot worse than I think perhaps what was construed initially on Friday. People are also bracing themselves for a few more aftershocks to come. But what we bear in mind is, in terms of economic fundamentals, the fiscal situation becomes even more precarious. You know, just when we were thinking that it can't be more precarious than this. So these are, of course, the downsides, and it's hammering the stock markets without a doubt. But at the same time, you know, historically, there's always been a bit of a boost to the markets once the rebuilding process starts, and we are quite confident that the rebuilding process and the recovery process will begin in Japan sooner rather than later. So I would not prematurely declare that, you know, we are beginning what could be an aggressively bearish market in the Nikkei. That remains to be seen. People are just bailing out first and then thinking about it later.
The Bank of Japan intervened again today with about 8 trillion yen of additional liquidity. That's about 98 billion U.S. dollars. Do you expect further interventions? Do you think this will be enough? Will this boost confidence?
The view all along has been that BOJ perhaps has been a bit timid in terms of what it has been doing. I mean, if we look at the fact that the government really doesn't have very deep coffers to dig into, then naturally the Bank of Japan must pick up the slack from there. So it would not surprise us if BOJ went to do more.
Also, not just Japan suffering economically, but many other markets in Asia were down some sharply. Is this a sign that Asia is very integrated economically?
That is something that cannot be refuted. Over the years, I think Asia has become perhaps more linked. The supply chains form, whether it's vertically or horizontally, and this, of course, is being reflected in some of the fears.
Vishnu Varathan, an Asia analyst with Capital Economics Group in Singapore. He says Japan has not been viewed as a major demand source or a major exports destination. In terms of high-tech product production, Taiwan and South Korea will be able to pick up the demand for such products, while China will continue to be a destination for many Asian products. Well, as authorities work to avert a disaster at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, the situation there is prompting countries across the globe to reevaluate the safety of existing nuclear plants and their plans to build new atomic facilities. VOA's William Ide in Washington reports.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday announced a three-month review of plans to continue operating her country's 17 nuclear power plants. The plants had been scheduled to be phased out by 2020, but Ms. Merkel's government agreed last year to keep them online for an additional 12 years.
We know how safe Germany's nuclear power plants are, but it is also true that we cannot yet ignore the importance of nuclear energy as a bridging technology if we want to continue to cover our own energy consumption.
Switzerland has suspended the approval process for three nuclear power plants so safety standards can be reconsidered, and India has ordered safety and inspections for all of its nuclear plants. Chinese officials say they will learn from what has happened in Japan, but stress that the pace of the country's plans to build new reactors will not be affected. China is aggressively expanding its nuclear power industry. Industry experts say explosions at three reactors in Japan will seriously affect what many call a nuclear renaissance, a growing shift toward nuclear power as an alternative to fossil fuels. The World Nuclear Association, which promotes nuclear power and related industries around the world, says 155 new nuclear reactors are planned or are under construction, most of them in Asia. International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Yukio Amano says it's too early to tell how the crisis in Japan will affect the nuclear power industry.
In my view, this is not an accident by design or by human error. This is an accident caused by natural disaster that is unprecedented.
Amano says the situation in Japan does not change the fact that the world needs a stable source of clean energy to mitigate the impact of climate change. Australia's Prime Minister Julia Gillard says her nation has plenty of alternative sources of energy and does not need nuclear power. The United States has not brought a new nuclear power plant online since before the accident at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island facility in 1979. Speaking at a White House press briefing on Monday, Deputy Secretary of Energy Daniel Pohlman said nuclear power accounts for 20% of U.S. energy production and must be a part of the nation's clean energy policy.
We do see nuclear power as continuing to play an important role in building a low-carbon future, but be assured that we will take the safety aspect of that as of our paramount concern.
President Barack Obama is seeking tens of billions of dollars in government loan guarantees for the construction of new U.S. nuclear power plants. But Ellen Banco of the Union of Concerned Scientists says the situation in Japan will only add to the troubles nuclear power faces in the United States.
The nuclear industry was in trouble in the United States long before last week's earthquake and tsunami, spiraling construction cost estimates, declining energy demand, low natural gas costs, and the failure to put a price on carbon already spell trouble for this industry.
For now, Vanco says the crisis in Japan will likely lead to safety inspections at all U.S. nuclear power plants. William Ide, VOA News, Washington.
Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. The commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, appears before lawmakers on Capitol Hill today to discuss the U.S.-led military effort in the war-torn country. Petraeus is testifying at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing just one day after meeting with U.S. President Barack Obama and Defense Secretary Robert Gates on Afghanistan. The Associated Press news agency says Petraeus is expected to tell lawmakers that the Taliban's momentum has been reversed in a number of important areas and that forces can begin to withdraw later this year as planned. But the agency quotes Petraeus in his prepared testimony as saying he's concerned that levels of funding for U.S. civilian assistance efforts will not be enough to build on the security gains the military has made. The White House says Petraeus, President Obama, and Gates discussed the effectiveness of the military surge in Afghanistan, the growth of the Afghan National Security Forces, and President Hamid Karzai's expected March 21st announcement on beginning a transition to Afghan security, taking the lead. Thailand's government is facing a no-confidence vote this week, accused by the opposition of mismanagement, corruption, and orchestrating the violent end to last year's anti-government protests. Thai lawmakers are holding 3 days of debate on the allegations, even as anti-government protests continue. Analysts say Prime Minister Apisit Wichachiwa's coalition is likely to survive the vote as long as the established powers continue backing it. However, it will be weakened, and an upcoming election is not likely to heal divisions. VOA's Daniel Sharp reports from Bangkok.
Thailand's main opposition, the Pua Thai Party, is accusing Thai Prime Minister Apisit Wichachiwa and nine other ministers of abuse of power and mismanaging the country. The government is defending its actions during 3 days of debate among Thai lawmakers. The opposition's accusations range from failing to control rising food prices to shirking responsibility for last year's violent clashes in Bangkok between the military and anti-government demonstrators. From March through May, about 90 people, mostly civilians, were killed after the government ordered soldiers to clear thousands of protesters demanding new elections from the city streets. Pavin Chachawan Pongpan is a research fellow at Singapore's Institute of Southeast Asian Studies.
What happened in May last year has not really been resolved. And also the fact that the government has been reluctant to admit any guilt during the crackdown, I think that could be a serious issue that could kind of cause an impact on the government credibility and legitimacy.
Despite the criticism, spokesman Panattan Watanayagorn insists the investigation is operating independently and the final results are delayed by the sheer scale of the investigation and court procedures. Many of the protesters, known as the Red Shirts, support the opposition and former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who was overthrown by the military in 2006 and now lives in exile to avoid prison on corruption charges. They say those who helped bring Mr. Apisa to power conspired in the coup and in removing successive governments loyal to Mr. Thaksin through court orders. The government denies this, while critics of Mr. Thaksin say he was authoritarian and corrupt. Mr. Apisa's government has faced down two votes of no confidence since 2009. Panattan says he is confident it can do so again.
This is not the first time that these issues have been promoted. In the last few months, the government successfully defended many of the issues. Some of these issues are quite old. For example, the issues of the handling of the demonstrators in the last year or two, it has been already submitted in the parliamentary system, and the government also already passed the censorship motion once already on this issue.
Meanwhile, nationalist protesters who demonstrated to remove Mr. Thaksin have turned against Mr. Apisit, accusing him of being soft in a territorial dispute with Cambodia. Known as the Yellow Shirts, they are also holding regular protests against the government. Thitinan Pong Satirak is a visiting professor of Southeast Asia Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. He says despite the growing pressures, Mr. Apisit's government is likely to survive the vote if its coalition partners stick with his ruling Democrat Party.
It depends on whether the backers will pull the plug on Apisit or not. So far, they don't have a better solution, a better arrangement than Apisit. So I think that the government will be weakened by this potential debate, but the coalition partners enjoyed having the pie, access to the pie, and the backers, the military, the army, the palace, and others are still lining up behind Apisit, not because he's the best that they want, but because they don't have anyone better.
The government says it will soon announce an election date expected around June. Opinion polls indicate no one party has enough support to win a clear majority, and a coalition government is likely. But analysts say the election will not likely heal Thailand's deep divisions, and that unless opposition forces are somewhat accommodating, the country could see further polarization or even a resumption of clashes. Daniel Scharf, VOA News, Bangkok.
Well, if you haven't looked, check out our Facebook page at VOA Asia. One of our interns, South Korean journalism student G.I. Choi, recently took a trip to New York City. You can view her photos on the site. I asked her about some of her adventures while in New York.
I took a lot of photos. I was there for 3 days, but I took 900 photos. I'm not kidding. That was like more than 1 gigabyte. I couldn't save that in my small laptop, so I'm doing that photo story in this office. But yeah, like New York City was just amazing for me because it just looks like drama or movie for me. How I Met Your Mother, Sex and the City, Spider-Man, Batman, like everything was there because I really like the movies. And so what I took was usually about the movies. Like I took some photo of Gotham City, even though that doesn't exist, but I actually found some scene that actually seems like movie. And I took photo of Central Park. It looks like Home Alone 2 for me. It took the photo of a pizza shop that Spider-Man had part-time job, and which was really small, but I still can feel like I am in the same place as Spider-Man.
And the pizza there looks really good.
Yeah, the pizza was, I have to say that it was one of the best pizza I've ever had.
It's really good. So I took the fresh mozzarella,
but I strongly recommend people to try pepperoni because I couldn't try that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm doing the photo story now, so mm-hmm. I will upload more photos. Yeah, but you can still see some photos of M&M's World, which is amazing.
By any chance, when you were in New York, did you go to any Korean restaurants?
Yeah, I went to Korean restaurants. Actually, it's one of the things that I will post soon. Cool. There is a Korea town, like small Korea town, in front of the Empire State Building, and I think it's called K Street, and it just looks like Korea. It was really, really weird for me because I was in Manhattan before, but like after 2 minutes, suddenly I fell into Korea again. It's like there are Korean banks and Korean street fairs, like Korean restaurants, Korean karaoke, and like everything. You can meet like every Korean people in there. So I actually went to Korean restaurants because I really miss the food from my own country. So I don't know about that too, but it's actually a little bit different from other restaurants in Korea because it's like changed in a like, certain way in New York. So I think it's interesting too. So I think I will note that too.
Okay, well, we look forward to seeing that on VOA's Asia Facebook page. VOA South Korean intern G.I. Choi speaking about her recent trip to New York City. Well, thank you for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for the latest world news on International Edition with Kate Woodsum, coming up next on many of these same radio frequencies. From Studio 23 in Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. New fears grip Japan as another explosion hits the Fukushima nuclear power plant. We learn what went wrong with Japan's tsunami warning system, and we hear the latest on the crisis in Libya. I'm Kate Woodsum, in for Paul Westfelling in the VOA News Center in Washington. Japanese officials say the radiation around a damaged nuclear plant has reached dangerous levels after a fire broke out in a storage pond holding used nuclear fuel rods. Our correspondent Steve Herman had been reporting from Fukushima, where the plant is located, but he has evacuated the area like most other residents seeking safety. He is now in Koriyama, 75 kilometers west of the nuclear plant. Steve, what are you seeing there?
We visited some evacuees earlier, and we happened to run into a family in a curry restaurant that had just left Iwaki here in Fukushima Prefecture. Iwaki is right on the edge of the 30-kilometer radius from the nuclear power plant, and people who live between 20 and 30 kilometers away from the number one Fukushima plant have been advised to stay indoors and close their windows and not use any air conditioners. They said they felt very nervous and just decided to get out of town, not believing that it was safe to stay there any longer. They said that they didn't feel that the information they were getting from the government was accurate, and really fear that possibly a meltdown has occurred at one or more of their reactors.
And how long are their fears that the government may not be telling them?
No one can tell you definitively whether there has been a meltdown. There's absolutely no evidence that there's a hammer down there. There's no one who can go and inspect it. And the only way we'll know there is a meltdown and that all of the casings have been violated, if there is some sort of massive release of radiation into the atmosphere. So we're at a stage right now where there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. If you talk to industry people, they'll tell you just as concerning, if not more, if we're talking about possibilities of large amounts of radiation being released, really doesn't deal with the reactor issues themselves, because those are fairly well protected, although there's a report that in number two reactor at Fukushima number one plant, that the containment vessel is damaged. But of greater concern is the spent fuel rod. So we've had explosions in two buildings at the Fukushima number one plant. And then there was the number four reactor, which had been out of service for maintenance when the earthquake hit. And there's been a fire there. Those spent fuel rods at number four, and we also believe that number one and number two reactors have been exposed to the atmosphere. And the fire from the rods at number four, the spent fuel rods, may be responsible for these higher radiation levels that we're starting to see in other parts of Japan today.
And as much uncertainty about the nuclear situation that there is, there must be equal amounts of anxiety. And what are people doing to protect themselves or to take care of themselves, if they can at all?
There's not a lot that people can do. Some people have fled the region. Other people are living in damaged homes, and they're trying to repair their homes. But there's basically, for here in Fukushima and then going north into Miyagi and Iwate prefectures, most businesses have been closed since the earthquake hit. And we've seen dwindling supplies in convenience stores in this area. And farther up north for days now, there's really nothing left on the shelves except for cigarettes and alcohol, and very few restaurants open. And if you're in a place that has electricity and running water, very, very lucky.
The government did order residents around the nuclear plant to evacuate the area. How many people are we talking about, and where are they going?
We're talking about a couple hundred thousand people. Evacuation zone extends 20 kilometers around the Fukushima number one nuclear plant and 10 kilometers around the Fukushima number two power plant. And some of these people have gone practically to Tokyo. Some of them are being sent more than 150 kilometers away because all of the shelters are filled up in Fukushima prefecture now. And then add to the fact that we have hundreds of thousands of other people that are displaced by the earthquake and tsunami. So you've really got triple tragedy.
Okay, Steve, well, be very careful, be safe, and take care.
Will do.
Steve Herman is our correspondent in Koriyama, Japan, west of the damaged nuclear plant. Today's fire was the latest setback for operators of the Fukushima nuclear plant, which suffered a failure of its cleaning systems following Friday's massive earthquake and tsunami. Japan is reporting the radiation levels to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which says high dose levels have been observed around the plant, but that the level of radioactivity is decreasing. They are monitoring the situation. On Monday, IAEA Director Yukiya Amano tried to ease concerns about the release of radioactive gas into the air, saying the plant has many layers of protection.
Nuclear reactors, BWR, boiling water reactor, have multiple safety measures. The nuclear core is contained in the reactor vessels. And that is made of iron steel. And then the reactor vessel is contained in the primary containment vessel that is made of ferro-concrete.
That's Yukiya Amano, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The agency said today that about 150 people from around the nuclear plant have received monitoring for radiation levels, and that 23 of them are being treated for decontamination measures. As our correspondent in Japan, Steve Herman, told us, the situation has caused alarm among residents near the nuclear plant. To find out just what threat they risk, though, my colleague Victor Beatty talked with Peter Burns, a 40-year employee of the Australia Radiation Protection Nuclear Safety Agency.
There will be a release of radioactive materials and people will get a small radiation dose, but until the containment vessels, if they remain there, maintain their integrity, they should contain the most serious fission products, which might be being released from the fuel elements if they're exposed and are degraded.
From what you understand, what are Japanese authorities trying to do to contain the radiation And are they being successful?
As far as I understand, they're trying to cool the reactor, cool the fuel rods, or fuel elements in the primary containment vessel, so that the buildup of gases and steam won't be that great. Because the reactors have all been off for 3 or 4 days now, it's really just the residual heat in the fuel elements that's there, so it's more easy to contain. It's not like a full ongoing reactor where there's much more heat that would need to be dissipated, so one would hope that if anything goes wrong, it wouldn't be quite as bad as, Chernobyl.
This power plant is some 40 years old. Would that have any bearing on the damage sustained?
What was designed, you know, like 50 years ago and built 40 years ago is probably not as good as what is built today. Everything evolves and develops, and from accidents people learn and build in extra layers of safety. As far as I understand it, it was more the siting of the emergency backup power supplies, which were below the sort of sea level where the seawall, you know, didn't stop the tsunami wave from coming in, where it was assumed that would be high enough to stop any tsunami coming in, but it wasn't. And that's why they got flooded now. If they obviously had been positioned a bit more judiciously, and this should be taken into consideration when you're doing these things so that they would survive any eventualities.
That's radiation expert Peter Burns, a former representative to the UN on the effects of atomic radiation. He spoke with my colleague Victor Beatty from his home in Melbourne, Australia. Well, as he just told us, Japan built some of its nuclear power plants near the coastline, but tried to protect them from ocean surges with seawalls. But nature's wrath Friday was just too big for the man-made walls, raising the question, what went wrong with Japan's tsunami warning system? I reached out to Kostas Sinalakis, a tsunami expert with the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Southern California.
Japan is one of the most well-prepared countries on Earth in terms of, you know, tsunami warnings. They had a warning, but I think what went wrong is that they had not anticipated, you know, the size of this event. And there are two reasons for it. One is that they haven't had any event in, you know, in recent memory in the last 100, 150 years that was, you know, anywhere as big as this one. And two, seismologists and geophysicists had not expected such a massive earthquake happening off Japan. So on both counts, part of the warning system is essentially to have inundation and flooding maps and make plans for people. I think that it is that part of the system that failed.
My understanding is 40% of Japan's coastline is lined with these concrete seawalls.
Yes.
And that would be part of what failed.
Well, the concrete seawalls in many places in Japan are about 10 meters, that's about 33 feet. In the Sendai, they were about 3 meters, that's about 10 feet. So that shows you that, at least in that area, they were not expecting such a size of a wave, because they would have built, you know, a higher seawall. And in some ways, the low seawall complicated things, because, I mean, sure, it's better than nothing, but on the other hand, you know, waves were trapped in, and quite possibly people were caught in a sense of security, and emergency managers, that they had sufficient defenses, which didn't prove to be the case.
And should these seawalls be redesigned, be built taller, or is it flawed thinking to say that man can hold nature at bay?
Well, it's both. If you overestimate or over, you know, invest in one part of the system, like building coastal defenses, and then you do not invest in the other parts of the system, like the backup systems and redundant systems, then you get what we just saw.
Now, as you said, Japan did use tsunami warning systems after the earthquake.
Yes.
But how fast does a tsunami travel, and how fast and how far and how high would you have to run to get away from it?
You know, the answer depends on what part of the coast you're at. If you're on a coastline that's fairly flat, you have, like, I mean, some of the images that you saw, I mean, the tsunami was, you know, advancing past rice fields and over what looked like greenhouses, etc. So it's a fairly flat area. You have to go in, you know, fairly far inland, at least, you know, 3 miles, 4 miles. And if you have about, you know, half an hour to run, I mean, you know, being 3 miles in half an hour, that's a, you know, good jog. Most people wouldn't be able to do that. I think in Japan, they have planned for vertical evacuation structures, so people would evacuate to sturdy buildings that are nearby, and in some cases, the building, special evacuation structures, but quite possibly, and most of their defenses and most of their evacuation structures were probably designed too low, because they were not expecting this size of a wave.
Now, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has increased the number of sensor buoys that can help to alert nations that a tsunami is on the way. But what do you feel is still missing in the world's preparedness for these potential disasters?
I'm fairly disappointed that almost 6 years after we've had the Indonesian tsunami, still we're still lacking in certain areas. I mean, one is public education. And then, around the world, as we go around the Pacific, and we see failures of the system. For example, in Samoa, people evacuated by car, and there were traffic jams, and people drowned, and, the hills were only very close. They were, in some cases, they were 300 feet away. They would have easily climbed up the hill 30 feet and would have been safe versus waiting in a traffic jam to move away from the beach. What we saw in Sumatra, in Indonesia, last October, another tsunami, is that the government relied on signs that go underneath the TV screens and interrupt the broadcast, saying that there's a tsunami warning, evacuate. Well, hello. Most of the villages at risk in the Mentawai Islands do not have any electricity. They could have had sirens, and they could have been powered by solar generators, solar panels. We could have communicated with signals like what we have in mobile telephones, but they didn't. So it's gaffes like this that should just not happen.
Kostas Sinalakis is a tsunami expert at the University of Southern California. Japan's natural disasters have taken a serious toll on the economy. Tokyo's stock market dropped sharply today, fueled by fears about the worsening conditions at the nuclear power plant north of Tokyo and electricity supply problems. Martin Williams reports from Tokyo.
The benchmark Nikkei index of major stocks registered its third largest fall ever, dropping more than 10%. Trading volume on the Tokyo market's first section was a little under 6 billion shares, hitting a record high for the second straight day. The selling was across all industries, but electricity and gas companies led the way. Tokyo Electric Power Company, the operator of the nuclear plants, fell by the maximum allowable amount in a flood of sell orders. Major manufacturing companies also saw losses. Investors are worried about the damage incurred by Friday's earthquake and tsunami and problems caused by continuing power rationing. Toyota has halted all domestic assembly lines until Wednesday. Sony has 6 plants shut, including one that was flooded by Friday's tsunami. And Toshiba says it's uncertain when a chip plant in northern Japan will reopen. Mitsuru Yonekawa, a spokesman for carmaker Nissan, says the company plans to reopen plants later this week.
We have to be check all the lines and the facility itself, and of course we have some supply shortage.
Planned rolling electricity blackouts, which began on Monday and could continue for more than a month, but to help cope with a 27% drop in generation capacity as a result of nuclear power stations being offline. They will be extended to areas of northern Japan Wednesday. Disruption to fuel supplies is bringing further problems for companies. Queues grew outside central Tokyo gas stations on Tuesday, and some were closed because delivery trucks had not arrived. In Tokyo, Martin Williams, VOA News.
Time for our letters segment, where I read your thoughts, concerns, and reactions to our stories. Japan's crisis has generated hundreds of comments on our website, voanews.com, and on our Facebook page, VOA Asia. One listener, Michael in Japan, says he lives near the worst area. He says what is needed is hard decisions. The government must react now and stop acting like a tanker heading for a disaster. Another listener named Brody in Australia says, scrambled communications, it's becoming increasingly difficult to follow this story. Old facts being stated as new, old facts being released days after happening. It makes you wonder why some news sites even bother posting, as most of their news is more like history. One of our audience members, Michael, in the United States, wrote to us on our website, and he said, being prepared for such disasters is not only the individual's responsibility, but the community and the national government as well. Michael wrote that not the prevention, mind you, but have a plan and resources available in the event this occurs. He implores those reading to start a disaster plan and make yourself a 72-hour emergency kit today. Michael says that his heart goes out to the Japanese people. One of our audience members will confirm their name is Finn. And this audience member says future nuclear power plants should have the ability to stand the natural disasters like the one that hit Japan. Otherwise, we are doomed to more disasters because the current trend is that we are going to see more natural disasters more often. Again, that was a listener in Burma. If you want your thoughts read on our show, write to us at crossroads@voanews.com. And for guidance on how you can help the people of Japan, visit our Facebook page dedicated to Asian news. That's VOA Asia on Facebook.com. Send us your thoughts on the story and tell us what questions you want answered. Libya, where forces loyal to leader Muammar Gaddafi have launched another airstrike on the rebel-held eastern town of Ajibaya, moving closer to the rebels' main stronghold of Benghazi. Witnesses say today's aerial bombings hit the town's western edge. Pro-Gaddafi forces bombed the same town on Monday, while also targeting the western coastal town of Zawara, one of the few western towns that rebels were able to seize when the revolt began a month ago. There is confusion about which side is in control of the oil port of Briga. Late reports Monday said a rebel force had taken the town's residential district, while pro-Gaddafi forces controlling its oil facilities. In the United States, two high-ranking U.S. senators are calling on the Obama administration to recognize Libya's opposition, as France has already done. They are urging the United States to impose a no-fly zone with other countries to aid rebels battling forces loyal to leader Muammar Gaddafi. As our correspondent at the Senate, Michael Bowman, reports, the senators introduced a resolution on Monday urging prompt U.S. intervention in Libya.
Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona says the situation in Libya is growing increasingly grim.
At this moment, opponents of Gaddafi and his supporters are fighting for their very survival. Gaddafi has unleashed a merciless campaign of violence against the Libyan people, including civilian non-combatants, using every tool at his disposal.
Forces loyal to the Libyan leader have continued an offensive against rebel towns in the east of the country. Over the past week, the rebel advance west has been pushed back nearly 200 kilometers. Speaking on the Senate floor, McCain said the United States cannot remain on the sidelines of the conflict and watch Mr. Gaddafi reassert control over Libya.
First, the president should recognize Libya's Transitional National Council, which is based in Benghazi, and representative of communities across the country, the sole legitimate governing authority of Libya, just as the government of France has done. Second, the president should take immediate steps to implement a no-fly zone in Libya with international support.
On Saturday, the Arab League endorsed the idea of a no-fly zone and said it would ask the UN Security Council to impose such restrictions. The White House said it welcomed the Arab League position, saying the international community is unified in sending a clear message that the violence in Libya must stop. McCain said a no-fly zone would not by itself assure defeat of Mr. Gaddafi's forces, but would provide a boost to rebels when they need it most.
It is Libyans themselves who want to do the fighting against Gaddafi, but they want it to be a fair fight, and so should we.
President Obama has said Mr. Gaddafi is on the wrong side of history, and the U.S. leader has not decided on any military action, but is still considering imposing a no-fly zone. Critics of a no-fly zone say it is an act of war and could embroil the United States in another conflict in the Arab world on the side of forces whose ultimate intentions are not yet clear. Those arguments are rejected by independent Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman, Lieberman of Connecticut, who also sponsored the proposed resolution. Lieberman said the anti-totalitarian revolution sweeping northern Africa must not be allowed to fail in Libya.
There's a danger that what's happening in Libya is essentially a wall being put up which says this peaceful democratic revolution in the Arab world ends here. To put it another way, that the Arab Spring may be going the way of the Prague Spring of 1968. We simply cannot let that happen.
For weeks, the two senators have urged a more active U.S. response to events in Libya. In the United States, the executive branch bears responsibility for conducting foreign policy. Congress may urge and advise the president on foreign matters. If adopted, the proposed Senate resolution cannot force President Obama to intervene in Libya, but could add weight and political backing to any decision he may ultimately make. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Tonight, an update on the situation in Haiti. The United States, citing concerns for Haiti's stability, has urged former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide not to return to his homeland until after the country's March 20th presidential election. The controversial Haitian figure has lived in exile in South Africa since his ouster in 2004. Anyways,
officials here are not challenging Mr. Aristide's right to return home, which they say is assured by the country's constitution. But they say his immediate return in the run-up to the country's March 20th presidential runoff election can only be seen as an effort to influence the country. The former Haitian president has lived in shortly after being driven from office more than 7 years ago by a popular uprising. He expressed a desire to return home after former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier made a surprise return in January. Both South African officials engaged in the so his return is imminent. The United States has strongly supported the current electoral process as critical to Haiti's stability after years of political turmoil and the disastrous 2010 earthquake. State Department Acting Deputy Spokesman Mark Turner questioned the timing of the former leader's apparent decision.
To return this week could only be seen as a conscious choice to impact Haiti's elections. We would urge former President Aristide to delay his return until after the electoral process has concluded to permit the Haitian people to cast their ballots in a peaceful atmosphere. Return prior to the elections may potentially be destabilizing to the political process.
Turner said the United States encourages the South African government, as what he termed a partner to Haiti's stability, to also urge Mr. Aristide to delay his return. Mr. Aristide, a former Roman Catholic priest, led a popular revolt that ended Haiti's three-decade Duvalier dictatorship and was elected president in 1990. He was ousted by the military the following year, but returned to office amid U.S. military pressure in 1994. He was forced to leave the country again a decade later amid protests of what was seen as autocratic rule. Mr. Aristide has said that if he returns home again, he will remain a private citizen and educator. The March 20th presidential runoff in Haiti pits former First Lady Nirlande Maniga against pop singer Michel Martelly. The electoral process to choose a successor to outgoing President René Préval has been controversial, with an initial round of voting in November criticized by international observers as fraud-ridden. David Gallas, VOA News, the State Department.
And that's our show for today. Thank you for joining us on International Edition. And before I go, I'll invite you again to share your thoughts on the news. Email us at crossroads@voanews.com. Until tomorrow, today's program was directed by Felicia Butler. Engineering was handled by David Boddington. The managing editor is Barry Newhouse, and I'm Kate Woodcomb in the VOA News Center in Washington.
an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In remarks commemorating the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took special note of the efforts the women in the Middle East have made on behalf of freedom and democracy.
They have insisted that their voices be heard. And in the coming months and years, the women in Egypt and Tunisia and other nations have just as much right as the men to remake their governments, to make them responsive, accountable, transparent.
In recent years, the voices of the women in Iran have been particularly resonant in calling for equality and human rights. Iranian women have organized a grassroots effort to obtain 1 million signatures aimed at overturning the country's discriminatory gender laws. Female human rights lawyers defend the children and women in an attempt to protect them from injustice and violence. Iranian women have been in the forefront of the pro-democracy demonstrations that brought millions into the streets after the disputed presidential election of 2009. And how has the Iranian government reacted? Scores of activist women have been arrested, denied due process, and sentenced to long prison terms. Thousands demonstrating for freedom in the streets of Iran have been viciously beaten. One, Nedo Oga Sultan, was shot to death, and the photograph of her bloody face became the icon of the Iranian struggle for liberty and individual rights. And still, Iranian women do not give up. For International Women's Day this month, they called for new demonstrations in favor of women's rights and for the release of Zahra Ranavard and Fatemeh Karoubi, the wives of opposition figures Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi, who have been under arrest since the middle of February. Peaceful demonstrators were met by hundreds of security forces wielding tear gas and batons. At a press briefing, then State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley decried the mistreatment by the Iranian regime.
We support these brave women, as well as those facing continued political persecution at the hands of a government that has imprisoned over 100 women for their political views. Many of them have been arrested, tortured, and subject to lengthy detention without charge. Family members have been jailed and harassed, and they have been barred from organizing on behalf of women.
The United States, said Mr. Crowley, recognizes the important leadership role that Iran's women play in civil society and the struggle for all Iranians to express their universal rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing off. For information regarding the times and frequencies of VOA programs, write to Program Schedules, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, or access us on the Internet at www.voa.gov.